This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Saturday Magazine, sponsored by Velocity Rewards,
your award-winning loyalty program for Virgin Australia's frequent flyers.
This is Saturday Magazine.
Who we got next, Lisa?
Jess Hill has written what is an incredible book. I haven't read it myself, but I do intend to. It is called See What You Made Me Do, and it's a discussion about domestic violence here in Australia. Welcome, Jess.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Jess, how did it come about that you wrote this book?
Well, I spent most of all of 2015 writing about domestic abuse, and especially writing about how victims of family violence and their children are dealt with in the family law courts, horrifically as it is. And then I was commissioned to write a book. And to be honest, by the time I was asked to write this book, I was pretty spent on the issue of domestic violence, and I didn't know if I had it in me. And I thought, well, I might spend another 6 months putting something together. This book really should be written, because actually there has been no book written by a journalist in Australia about the phenomenon of domestic abuse ever.
So, is that true?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, you know, this is a really serious obligation to do this properly. And I thought, you know, I've done quite a lot of work on this, 6 months ought to do it. And now, 3.5 years later, I've come out with a book. So, yeah, it didn't quite go to plan, but but I ended up getting, you know, really drawn in a way that I didn't expect. And it's, as much as it's an incredibly disturbing topic, it's also one that is incredibly fascinating about what it tells us about the way that we deal with intimacy and power.
Now, you've said recently that your understanding of what domestic violence is changed through the writing of the book. How and why did that happen?
Yeah, so, well, it changed over, you know, numerous times. But I guess the initial impression that I had when I first started writing about domestic abuse was that, you know, it's guys who overreact in heated situations and lash out at their partners.
So kind of as a result of stress or something like that.
Yeah, stress or drugs or alcohol. You know, that was my very incredibly naive understanding. And what I came to understand is that domestic abuse happens on a spectrum, if you like, of power and control. And at the top end, there is a system of power and control that is implemented strategically, and it's the pattern repeats time and again. And that system is called coercive control. It's the most dangerous form of domestic abuse. And it's the types of patterns that you see that women talk about time and again are isolation, gaslighting, degradation, threats. You know, so there's a similar pattern the whole way through. At the core of it is control, and basically an attempt to take away that person's sense of self-worth, their sense of identity, and their sense of autonomy. And then further down the spectrum, you do have those guys, the guys that I thought of, and I think the guys that a lot of us think of when we think about men's violence against women, the guys who do have profound issues with intimacy and who do respond badly to stress, who will lash out instead of being able to talk about their issues, and they're much further down. They're not trying to implement a strategic campaign of domination the way that these other men at the top end of the spectrum are. So I guess I started to get a better understanding of how domestic abuse differed. And it's really important for us to understand that, because not all domestic abuse is the same, but yet we sort of treat it like it is.
Because we sort of see a lot of the general thought about domestic abuse is that it's a physical thing, and of course it's not. You know, it can be things like financial abuse and that sort of thing. What sort of elements have you pinpointed that we may not have defined as domestic abuse that are elements of power in a relationship?
Well, I guess, you know, it's difficult when you talk about elements, because when you talk about them one by one, it's not until you see them working together that you really see how damaging they are to people. So I guess if we talk about, so, you know, coercive control, which I was just mentioning before, which is the most dangerous form of abuse, that is basically, in a lot of those cases, you may have no physical violence at all. it's held together by fear. So you only need to have the believable threat of violence in order to hold that person in the relationship and stop them from leaving. And the sorts of things that you see in those relationships are first of all, is that establishing love and trust. And a lot of survivors will talk about this love bombing process where it was just like a fantasy, you know, and they get really drawn in and then they do all the things that we do when we're in intimate relationships. They share all their most personal details. And those details in the hands of an abuser become a blueprint for abuse. And the way, so each individual situation is different, but the basic components of coercive control are first isolation, which could be geographic or just cutting the victim off from their supportive connections, then to basically monopolize the victim's perception so that they're constantly focused on what their faults are. So, like, you know, I wouldn't be doing this to you if you weren't like this. Maybe you need to fix yourself. So they stop thinking about what's wrong with him and they begin to think about what's wrong with them. Then they get this next stage, which is so common in domestic abuse, which is what's known as gaslighting, where basically the perpetrator will deny the victim's reality and try to replace it with their own. Mm. In really extreme cases, you've got, you know, victims who are having their keys moved, they're having their wallet moved, and when they're saying they can't find it, the perpetrator's like, well, are you going mad? But knowing all along that they've moved it to make them feel anxious and uneasy. Another thing that's really, really common is enforcing trivial demands. So, like, you know, you must do the vacuuming a certain way, the blinds must be just a certain, a few inches off the floor. And the whole point of that is to breed into a victim compliance so that she feels like she must comply with whatever demands are being made, otherwise she'll be punished. And just in that last couple of two that I'll just mention is perpetrators will often demonstrate omnipotence by surveilling and monitoring their victim's behaviour, such to the point where the victim feels like they've almost got godlike powers and there's no way that they'll ever find a place to be safe. And then degradation and threats, not only to the victim, but to their friends, families, pets, basically to make them feel like resistance is futile and the only thing they can do is try to survive.
Given that coercive control is such a kind of murky, I mean, it's obviously you've well defined it, but how does the legal system fall down in terms of dealing with elements that aren't easily seen, like bruises and obvious elements of domestic abuse?
Well, you know, it's patchy. So some magistrates will be really good at picking up on obvious signs of control in relationships, but they have to really know what they're looking for and they have to be asking the right questions. And it's not really, in terms of the way the legal system is set up, that's not, the onus is not on them to do that. That's sort of an option. So the legal system is set up to prosecute incidents, mostly of physical abuse. Maybe, you know, stalking is also an offence, but most of the things that happen inside coercive control and some of the most horrifically degrading things that can happen, like forcing their partner to eat off the floor or, you know, I mean, and forcing them to sleep in the car, those sorts of things, that's not against the law, you know. And what we see in the courts is that perpetrators are pulled up on specific incidents, but that doesn't actually give any indication really of how severe the abuse is, because there might be a one-off physical incident, like a punch or a slap or whatever, that may be completely devoid of any other context. It might not be part of control, but that will be dealt with the same way as a coercive controller coming to court for a punch or a slap. And they're two very different forms of abuse with two very different potential outcomes. Homicide is a lot more likely in situations that are a lot more controlling. So at the moment, we don't have a law to prosecute coercive control, which is to say we actually don't have a law that can investigate the full spectrum of an abusive relationship and assess it for the danger that it actually poses. But they do have laws like that in the UK.
So what sort of suggestions do you have for alleviating that sort of thing?
Well, I guess, you know, today I've got an op-ed in the Saturday paper talking about a few things. I think we should look at making coercive control a crime. I know that's a controversial suggestion and there's you know, a number of legal bodies who have rejected it, but I think that we now see evidence of it starting to work overseas, especially in Scotland, where new laws have been introduced. So I think that's one thing, just to show people what is going on, this repetitive pattern of abuse. There's an incredible model in South America called Police Stations for Women, which are basically, they're not traditional police stations. They're in brightly painted houses, and they're staffed mostly by female officers. And the point is for domestic abuse victims to come into a place that's inviting, that's comfortable, where they will look after their children while they're being interviewed by police, and where police will respond to what the woman needs, not to whether a law has necessarily been broken or not, or how to prosecute that, but maybe she needs them to go around and just speak to the abuser or say, can you please, you know, get him to leave the house. And there are two other models that I talk about that have had incredible results in reducing domestic homicide and reducing abuse. And those models, we probably don't have time to go in detail, but basically they hinge on collaboration between police, social service agencies, the judicial system, and community groups. And what they tell the perpetrator is, we are watching you, we want to help you, we love and respect you, and we want you back in the community as a functioning member. But if you choose to not stop your violence, then we will come after you and all of the loopholes will be closed. You will not get away with it like you've been getting away with it before. And some of the things I talk about in the book, I mean, the kinds of results they're seeing in one city in the United States is a two-thirds drop in domestic homicide. In Bourke in New South Wales, another model is showing it was a 40%, almost 40% drop in domestic violence-related assaults. You know, so there are models that are working, and there are lots of things being done around the country that's working, but it's all very disparate and sort of disorganized. And in the meantime, we're putting a lot of emphasis on, you know, getting generational change in attitudes and behaviors instead of actually really looking at what can we do to protect women and children today.
Jess, I know your main focus is coercive control and domestic abuse in general, but I feel like, is there a gap in the market in terms of discussions about the GLBTIQ community? Have you stumbled across things in your travels about that? I feel like it's the great unspoken for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was something I really wrestled with when I was writing the book, because I knew midway through I just wasn't going to have the time or the space to really give that the scope it deserves. But I think a lot of men and women in same-sex relationships will see the patterns that they're experiencing reflected in this book, because basically what we're talking about is power imbalances. So, for example, with coercive control, that's mostly in heterosexual relationships. It's almost exclusively perpetrated by men because there needs to be a particular power imbalance to make it work. But in same-sex relationships, power imbalances aren't based on gender necessarily. But it's interesting, I mean, I did some research, I did quite a lot of reading on this and sort of what the thinking is on how does it all fit under the same banner. Like, it can't be about gender inequality, right? You know, if it's a same-sex relationship. But what you hear often from women in same-sex relationships and from men are the sorts of things that their partner might convince them or threaten them with if they report is that they'll be exiled from their community. Or they'll bring shame on same-sex relationships. They'll be laughed at by police. Or they may even be outed if they're a same-sex status in public, or even have their HIV status revealed. And so in that way, same-sex partner abuse is essentially produced by the same patriarchal conditions that produce men's violence against women, because it's held in place by the heterosexism and homophobia that's basically central to patriarchy.
So it can basically be understood in a similar way, but possibly dealt with in a different way.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think all of this really needs to come back to, I mean, there's certain generalizations we can make, but I think it's really important to come back to the individual needs of each perpetrator and victim, you know, because, you know, in same-sex relationships, well, they're going to have all sorts of different struggles again in terms of whether they feel comfortable coming to police and a number of other things. But, you know, there's a lot of thinking out there now that even though things like substance abuse, addiction, mental illness, they don't necessarily cause domestic abuse at the root, that maybe if we deal with those things, maybe if a perpetrator is able to address their substance abuse or is able to get help for mental illness, they may actually stop their violence. So I think there's a bit of a disconnect between what we acknowledge as the root cause of domestic abuse and what we can see as being a possible treatment for individuals who are expressing this.
Thank you, Jess. Sorry, we're out of time. Look, I appreciate your work. The book is called See What You Made Me Do. It's from Black Ink Books. Jess Hill is the author. Thank you, Jess.
Thanks, Jess.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Cheers.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.